Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk to the author of Philanthropy in America, A History. Olivier Zons, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to have read the book and to have this chance to talk with you. As I mentioned, this is an issue that's of particular interest to me, and so I read this book very closely. I read all the books for the podcast very closely, but I read yours extra closely. Before we get to the book, maybe you can tell us just a little bit about yourself, where you are now, where you've been, and what precedes this book.
Well, I have been at the University of Virginia as a professor of history for now 36 years. So I'm a longtime faculty member here. I grew up in France, got interested in American history in my early 20s. One thing led into another, and I ended up spending most of my adult life on this side of the pond, as the British would say. Now, I think of myself basically as a historian of the United States. I've written a number of books, mostly on the late 19th and 20th century. The one that preceded my book on philanthropy was entitled Why the American Century, and I ended the title with a question mark. So the book was an attempt to answer America's rise to a world power and to give an explanation for it. And this is in working on this book that I kind of stumbled on the topic of philanthropy. That is mostly... I came to this topic from the history of science standpoint. Part of the argument that I made in my American Century book and that I tried to sustain was that what made America powerful on the world scene was not so much was certainly in part the collapse of Europe in the First World War and the ways in which the various European countries were very good at killing one another, but also because Americans created a new world of knowledge, a science-based economy. And part of this creation involved the creation of the graduate school and of a scientific establishment. This is where I realized the role that philanthropy really was playing in this major transformation of the country. You know, there were fewer than 50 graduate students in this country in 1870. So here we are. And then I, when thinking about this issue, I realized there was a much broader topic behind it, and that got me to this book that you've just read.
Yeah, so you write these, what I think could be described as big books on big issues that cover large spans of time. Before we get to some of the big stuff, I wonder if you could start with just a definition, just sort of to sort of pull us all into the way you're thinking about the subject. How do you define or explain what the term philanthropy means today? What should it include? What do we put into that word that people use, you know, to mean lots of different things? What do you mean when you use it?
Well, of course, this is there's no relationship here between the length of the questions and the length of the answer. It's a simple question. It's a complicated answer. You know, it's a little bit the ways in which Tocqueville uses the word democracy. It has many different meanings. On one level here, I'm thinking of it in a rather traditional way, that is to say, philanthropy is an enterprise that is distinct from charity. That is actually in part designed against the waste of the charitable establishment in the late 19th century, against almsgiving, things that we know, investment in the search for root causes. I think all of this is basically correct. I also think of philanthropy, my take on it basically would be, how can it be that a capitalist society very much invested in profit making and thinking that the common good comes out of profit-making competition actually generates a very large non-profit sector where many of the rules of the games are similar to that of the profit sector, of the for-profit sector, except for profit itself, which then gets invested in causes much larger than any particular corporation or individual. And so I think of philanthropy as the name for all of the organizations that contribute to that.
You describe, you know, this is a history, and you describe the origins of philanthropy in America in some ways as a pact between the very rich and reformers. So around what did these two groups come together? What formed the basis of the common cause formed in the 1800s between those pushing for a variety of types of reforms of society and the very rich, the industrialists of the era?
Well, I want, if I may,
please,
before I answer this question, I want to say that I think of philanthropy and I deal with it in my book as a field that engages people from many different levels of wealth. And I say this because it's almost impossible really to understand what I'm trying to say about philanthropy if you think only about big money philanthropy and the big industrialists and the big fortunes, even though they're obviously a very big part of the story. I also think that pretty much what's made philanthropy, what has made it possible to be a very large contribution to the democratic project is a very broad investment from people from many different walks of life. And I think that's a key point. And I'm sure you're going to return to that at some point. But to answer your question, the way I view it was that, well, there are a number of reformers, social workers, professors, people in Protestant ministers or ministers from other religious affiliations, Catholic missions or Jewish charities, all could, and a number of them did, resent the rise of large fortunes. Certainly, you find most traces of that in the literature on the Gilded Age, with the rise of the robber barons, with the controversies of the Rockefeller tainted money, all of these things, and are basically true. That is to say, some of the very wealthy, many of them were engaged in practices that were thought perhaps not at the time to be illegal, but certainly became illegal at one point or another, and therefore you have a reaction to this among in reformist groups. Certainly, early in the 1920s, the University of Wisconsin would not accept any foundation money. The regents of the university would quickly resent that, actually. But you can see this very well. On the other hand, I think that the size of the resources that new fortunes allocated to philanthropic activities and the goals that they set for themselves and the advisors they recruited far outstripped the insignificance, the tainted money issue. I mean, in other words, it seems to me that in an era where basically there was no government fund for any of the large scientific ventures that philanthropy invested in, these resources were absolutely critical. and moreover, as being somebody who has, before writing my American Century book, wrote a book on corporate America, making America corporate, and had a chance to go through the archives of many very wealthy corporate builders. I could certainly see that at some point in people's lives, especially very wealthy people's lives, when they've made a pile of money, very quickly the goal becomes something else. I think Bill Gates is a good example of that, actually, as we think of it now. And so, therefore, always reducing this, never giving people the ability to move beyond. And if you're going to give people, if you're going to authorize, permit people in the society to make money, you have also to permit them to spend money. And I think this alliance between reformers looking for resources, where the resources were, and the owner of this resource is more than willing, dedicated to actually doing something important with them, was a historic meeting between perhaps strange bedfellows, but bedfellows that together changed the ways in which we do business.
Yeah. And we're going to sort of jump around in the history a little bit, and certainly go much faster than the book does. But we sort of understand philanthropy in this way, beginning primarily in the Northeast, some other places, but at least for some of the early portions of the book, that's where we see it. But then there's this spread to the South. Were the same social issues on the philanthropic agenda for Southern states as they were for Northern cities, Northeastern cities mainly? And were the philanthropists welcomed in the South in the same way that they were welcomed perhaps in New York City and Chicago and Boston and elsewhere? Talk about that move southward.
This is, again, historically a very important question because, you know, by the time the federal troops left the South after the end of Reconstruction, Rutherford Hayes went to the White House and Samuel Tilden didn't. And Reconstruction collapsed into redemption. Really, the major forces of change in the South were the philanthropists and remained the philanthropists pretty much. Against the local government, you know, enforced segregation until well into the 20th century. And I think, for example, of the significance of the Rosenwald Fund. Now, Julius Rosenwald was one of the key builders of Sears Roebuck. He was Jewish. He had known discrimination as a Jew, even though he was very wealthy. There was some hotels and resorts he couldn't go to, and so on and so forth. He embraced Booker T. Washington, someone I feel should be rehabilitated in history, because he was extremely courageous and dealing with extreme violence. And I think that anybody who became anybody in the civil rights movement was educated first in the Rosenwald School in the South. And one of the things that really amazes me is how silent the history of the civil rights movements are on this.
And which schools were these? We're talking about the plan to build schools in nearly every county.
Yeah.
What's the extent of this?
Well, I think I think Rosenwald built about 5,000 plus or minus a few dozens Rosenwald schools in various southern counties. They were elementary schools, but they were absolutely essential and in two ways. First, because the program always required a kind of cost sharing. From the from the African American communities involved, and therefore the portion of the world, it was the African American communities themselves would go to the Western World schools and to the Western World Fund and ask for support. Support came often in the form of supplies, building supplies, actually most of it coming from Sears. The communities, much of the support came in the form of labor, as African American communities had masons and carpenters and many skilled trades were well represented in them. The combination of these two things created a major change in the ways in which people excluded from education managed to get some.
And this last point, I think, really does take us back to one of the first points you made, which was that philanthropy grows from that of really something of a privileged few to a mass movement. And some of it was because of these kinds of cost sharing and institutions that were built to that invited philanthropy and donations from the middle class largely. So what facilitated this growth? What facilitated the movement from something that we maybe wrongly associate just with the very wealthy to something that became very enmeshed in what it meant to be in America?
Well, I think there are several aspects here that converge. First, I think there was certainly for a long and sustained period of time a significant rise in disposable income in among ordinary Americans. It's hard to conceive of it this way as we are experiencing an unusual level of inequality, but I think we can certainly always love to return to this essay by a German economist, 1906, Bernard Sombart, "Why is there no socialism in the United States?" And his answer was that because people were paid too well, you know, that class consciousness was wrecked on the shores of roast beef and apple pie. Well, whether this was true or not, yes, it was in part true. Not that there was not a violent and important labor movement in this country, there was one. But by and large, there was also a significant surplus of income among modest families. And very early in the 20th century, in family budgets collected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you find money set aside every month for the Red Cross. Not much, but a few bucks. I think mass philanthropy got a major boost during the First World War, as opposed to the current ways of war where we have our children and grandchildren pay the bill. Those bills were paid at the time, and there was a massive fundraising effort during the First World War, led by a consortium a partnership between the administration and major people coming from business and philanthropies. The key, therefore, became in part to sustain this fundraising effort after the war. But this fundraising effort, this massive fundraising effort, was also the outcome early in the 20th century of the public health movement, the fight against tuberculosis, the fights against other diseases. I always say, I should say in my book, and it's very significant, that the American Tuberculosis Society was created the same year as the Rockefeller Foundation. And actually, Jacob Riis, a major reformer, said, well, we're creating this because no major philanthropist is helping us, so we're going to do it ourselves. And so nickel and dime philanthropy began pretty much at the same time as sort of the creation of big foundations in this country. And it remains sustained through the Federation movement, the rise of community trust that became United Way. And of course, all of these funds are administered in the market. They are part of the capitalist management of money. But they are, of course, in the part of this nonprofit sector, they've been.
Okay, so a name that is likely familiar to many students of American history is also a part of your story. I wonder if you could explain to us how Margaret Sanger's work got caught up in the regulation of philanthropy and nonprofit organizations. This is a different aspect. Sort of much of the story up to this point has been a very nice story, but then things get a little bit more complicated. How did Margaret Sanger become a part of your story?
That's actually, I'm glad you asked me this question, because I think it's one of the more interesting biographical part of my book here. Clearly, there are a number, well, four or five different ways. I'm going to go fast on each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first one, of course, is that Margaret Sanger was completely 100% dedicated to her cause. And it was a difficult cause because distributing information on birth control early in the 20th century was considered pornographic by law. So medical journals couldn't even publish articles on birth control because they would lose their mailing permits. Margaret Sanger was arrested and jailed. Sometimes she generated those arrests herself for publicity purposes. But the long and the short of it is that she was fighting a good cause, but she was breaking the law, which is actually why I think I make a big point in my book all along that this notion that philanthropy must be apolitical is absurd. I mean, it's just complete fantasy, because you cannot work for the common good if you don't realize that there are many bad laws out there. So sometimes you have to break the law to be a good philanthropist. Now, Margaret Sanger had problems of raising money, especially as people didn't want to give money to a cause that they knew was illegal. She was not afraid. I mean, she I think partly adjusted her appeal to the cause of birth control by appealing to eugenists, by promising not only wanted babies but better babies. Now, remember that eugenics in the progressive era was still considered a progressive science. It was not discarded as the source of racism and atrocities that it has become later, or the source of abuses in the field of medicine, I think we have to avoid anachronistic judgments here. But Margaret Sanger certainly made an overture to eugenists as major, very wealthy Americans were funding the Eugenic Society, and therefore she was hoping, and she was successful in attracting some of that money. The other aspect of reason why Margaret Sanger comes into my story is because she also raised money quite effectively by marrying in a second marriage a wealthy industrialist who was very much in love with her and devoted her fortune to her cause. but at his own peril, because he was became the target of investigation by the IRS and lost his various appeals to and therefore lost his fortune. And in the end, Mr. Slee, as his name was no longer of great help to Margaret, who I think had married him basically for the purpose of tapping into his fortune. Third, as Margaret was losing this source of fund, she very successfully tapped into mass philanthropy by raising a small amount of money from women all across the country, therefore made an effective link, which I try to make in my book, between big money philanthropy, which she was after to begin with, and then mass philanthropy following that. So I think she's a very important figure for my book, in the sense that she demonstrates how an important movement needed, and of course Margaret Sanger won because birth control education became legal, first under medical supervision and then fully, so she won her case, and she successfully created the organization that today is Planned Parenthood. It was the Birth Control League when she was running it. So I made a connection here between big money philanthropy, mass philanthropy, and a major social movement, as well as a health issue.
Yeah. In the interest of time, maybe we can move forward a little bit.
I'm entirely at your disposal.
Yeah, it's because there's just so much to talk about today, and I think putting the work of the Gates Foundation, for instance, into the context of Carnegie and Ford 100 years ago is important to do. So how would you compare the work of the Gates Foundation today to the work and mission and view of the world of Carnegie and Ford and the philanthropists of 100 years ago? What do they share in common, and maybe what can we look to that separates them?
Yeah, okay. I have been somewhat criticized, by the way, for being too lenient with the Gates Foundation in my book. And I think I don't know a whole lot about their educational program, which is a big chunk of the foundation, but I've studied in great detail the program that they conducted in India for fighting AIDS, and it seems to me, as I was reading quite extensively through the sources at my disposal on this program, that it was a very significant help to the Indian people and the world, and it was a very genuine commitment on the part of the Gates Foundation to resolve this issue, and I was impressed by the level of commitment that I saw at the very top level of the foundation, including that of Bill and Melinda in this program, including the two of them, I think, visiting sex workers in India, and of course we can always, it's very easy to be cynical, and we can always say that this was all posturing on the part of wealthy, extremely wealthy, wealthiest Americans. But from what I saw, I understood some genuine feeling there, and that touched me. So that may explain why I was perhaps not critical enough of their work. The point is, I feel there's a direct line connecting Carnegie to Gates, in the sense that there is a similar feeling or understanding a century apart that huge fortunes do not necessarily belong to the people who make them, but they belong to society at large. I think that feeling is shared across times, and certainly connects Carnegie to Gates. I think what differentiates them greatly is that I don't think Bill Gates is a social Darwinist, while Carnegie was 100% social Darwinist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's in a nutshell my answer.
Yeah, no, and I think that one of the reasons why this is an important book to be read, not just by historians, but also by political scientists and sociologists and others, is because of how important philanthropy is in the world that we live in today, or perhaps as important as 100 years ago, but certainly in some different ways. I really enjoyed the book. I learned a lot from it.
Well, thank you.
So thank you. I really did appreciate Olivier Zun's book, now out in paperback, is from Princeton University Press. It's called Philanthropy in America, History. There's a new preface that leads the book. Olivier, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, you're most welcome. You're most welcome. Thank you for thinking of me.